Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. MIT is celebrating the 150th anniversary of its founding charter this year. Earlier this month, the Institute held its centerpiece event, the Next Century Convocation.
And the convocation looked back at a century and a half of research and educational innovation that emerged from MIT. And it culminated with the signing of an unofficial charter for the next 100 years. In that very tech way, this charter was signed with a quill pen on an iPad.
Much of the event has been a celebration of MIT's past, but when University President Susan Hockfield took the podium, she talked about the challenges of the present that face the nation and the world.
A very complicated time, one that tests the limits of human ingenuity and understanding. A time when the world has never depended more on the science and technology that we study and invent at MIT, but seems on the whole dangerously unable to understand that science and technology. And yet, ironically, a time when many question the value of higher education and the utility of government-sponsored research.
In other words, a very precarious time. MIT's president is with us in the studio now. Susan Hockfield, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's really a delight to have you. If I may, I'd actually like to start with a finding that you yourself have referenced several times and in other interviews before, and that's from a study that was put out by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development a few years ago. And they found that as recently as 1995, the United States ranked second in terms of college completion globally. And then in 2005, we dropped to 15th. And the reason why I raise this is it might be telling in terms of where higher education finds itself in America today. But the key thing is that OECD report said that the United States slipped in the rankings not because U.S. college graduation rates had dropped, but because it had actually gone up in other countries. So in a contrarian's perspective, is that maybe not such a bad thing?
Well, it wouldn't be a bad thing if we were not operating in a globally competitive world. And the reason that the United States has slipped to 15th in college completion rates without having decreased the number of students who are completing college or the percentage of students who are completing college is the fact that all around the world, developing nations, developed nations have so admired what the United States has achieved over the last 50 years and have understood that fundamental to those achievements is college education, that they have adopted our model and are excelling at that model at a greater level than we are. So if the world were standing still, it would be fine for us to be standing still. But the world isn't standing still, so it's important for us to accelerate.
So is part of the problem then, as you see, and you mentioned in your convocation address, that that Americans, maybe not in large numbers, but growing numbers, seem to be, you know, questioning, as you put it, the purpose, cost, and methods of universities. And I guess I also wonder, given what you see now across the board in higher education, is such a questioning a bad thing?
Well, I think it's always good to question assumptions. That is just in the nature of what we do at MIT. One never takes anything for granted. It's important to be appropriately skeptical. So I don't mind it being questioned. But what I do mind is a sense of, I would say lackadaisicalness about education in general and about higher education in America. The fact is that the very best of higher education in America and probably higher education as an enterprise in America is still the model for the world. We have applications at MIT, and every one of the top U.S. universities and colleges receive an enormous number of applications from students from around the world who want to study at American institutions because they still see these institutions as the very best. And all of the international rankings that we pretend we don't pay attention to, but of course everyone does, ranks the U.S. higher education institutions at the very top. So I think, that is a good position to be in, but I don't think we can rest on our laurels, and we won't maintain that position unless we as an American society, value this very important institution?
Well, maybe it's the product, if I may, that institution is delivering that people are beginning to question now. Because, as you said, folks around the world look to the United States as an example of what higher education should be. But I was doing my homework today, and there are many, many articles written in very well-respected magazines and major newspapers and tons of comments, Facebook tweets, et cetera, all over the map saying college is no longer delivering what I need from it most, meaning a job afterwards. It doesn't serve that central purpose anymore. First of all, what do you say to that? And what do you think the purpose of a college education is today?
Yeah, I want to address the employment question. So if you look at the employment statistics in the United States, and these are data from, not yesterday, but probably a month or two ago, the national unemployment is about 9%, roughly, a little bit less than that. But if you look at people who have not gotten high school diplomas, the unemployment rate is 15%. If you look at the unemployment rate among people who have high school graduation behind them but not high school, but not college graduation, the unemployment rate is 10%. For those who have a college degree, the unemployment rate is 5%. So I think that's pretty good data suggesting that your employment opportunities are greater if you have completed a college education.
Is that what you see as one of the central purposes of a university degree today?
Well, there are a lot of purposes to a university degree, and I would not say that employment is at the very top. What I would say at the very top is personal fulfillment and the achievement of one's personal ambition, the ability to serve society, the ability to advance the good of the world. These are all important things. And so I think it has both personal and social benefits. And I think that's really, what education is about, is equipping an individual with the qualities of mind that allow that person to have the most productive life he or she can, and to serve society in the greatest way.
So why is it that you think, then, that there seems to be this subtle, if not growing, shift in what Americans feel about the validity and purpose of higher education? What is it that's made you want to speak out about this so frequently in the past few years?
Yeah, what I often talk about is what's missing in the United States is a deficit of ambition. And I think as a nation, we hardly celebrate the achievements that one can attain if one has a college education. We are a nation that happily celebrates athletes and entertainers, and I think that's great. I think, athletes are demonstrating the highest possible achievement that they can physically, and entertainers also, but we do not have heroes that come out of a different kind of life. A friend of mine once said quite comically that every school child in Boston can probably name the starting lineup of the Red Sox, but very few can list three inventors. And yet the Boston region is just full of inventors doing amazing things to change lives in the world.
Listeners, what do you make of what MIT President Susan Hockfield just said, that the United States has a deficit of ambition? Are you one of the people who maybe questions the purpose of higher education today, specifically its mission in your life, and how about the cost? And what role do you see institutions such as MIT playing in the next 100 years, in America's immediate future, for American education and American competitiveness? And in general, what is your question for MIT President Susan Hockfield? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan Hockfield, there's so much more to sort of unpack here in terms of higher education. I also, a little later, want to get to this question of government funding of research, which is a major mission of many institutions, including yours. But if I can just dive a little bit more into the current day mission of universities. If you said that providing jobs or getting people maybe ready for immediate employment following their 4-year degree is one of the goals, but not the number one goal, what would you say is the top mission of universities today?
Well, I think the top mission of education is to allow people to be full citizens. It's one of the founding tenets of American democracy. Jefferson spoke about it, quite a bit, as did many of his colleagues at the time. that in order to be fully a citizen in any society, you need to be an educated person. You need to be able to understand the events of the day. You would be able to understand the arguments of the day, because there are a lot of choices before us all the time, and choices that can't be made without being an educated and serious thinker.
You know, there's been a lot of criticism recently of not just the purpose of American colleges and universities, but the means by which they seek to accomplish that. And, you know, for example, a lot of people look to what they call bloated student to faculty ratios. And I'm not saying this is going on at MIT, but sort of a blanket criticism that, especially amongst undergraduates, they're not actually encountering the professors who make the institutions great, but grad students, maybe adjunct fellows, things like that. All in all, they're having an experience that they don't feel is really worth the money that they're putting into it.
You know, it's a fascinating dilemma. It's a paradox that while people decry the cost of higher education, and it is expensive, and I can explain a little bit about that expense perhaps a little later, they also decry the population that actually conveys the teaching. One of the difficulties in higher education is there are very few economies of scale. The economy of scale is you have one professor teaching one student in a lab situation, perhaps, or in a tutorial. That's non-economic. And to have that one professor teach 1,000 students is, of course, more economical. But no one would suggest that that's a better form of education. And so, you know, you're kind of, you know, caught on the horns of the dilemma that, you know, you want students to have important experiences with their teachers, and yet it is really quite unwieldy and non-economic to provide the density of faculty that would be required at the very highest levels. One of the reasons why education has grown increasingly expensive is that our ambition for education has grown higher and higher. And, you know, one of the things that differentiates some of the more elite schools from some of the less elite schools is the student-to-faculty ratio.
Mm-hmm. Well, take me into that a little further, because, as you said, it's non-economic to have a one-to-one ratio, or possible even, doesn't sound possible at all. But on the other hand, on that argument, I guess what people are saying is the very professors that they want to take classes from aren't even doing any teaching at all. Yeah, that research is really trumps the educational mission.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about research and the important role of research in the context of higher education. There are people who believe that sufficient higher education can be delivered by people who are not participating in discovering and advancing the frontier of knowledge. And that is, there is a kind of education, and, you know, frankly, this is not inappropriate. Most high school teachers are not in the midst of research. They are learning about their fields by reading, but not by contributing to advancing the fields themselves. At universities, research universities, we have faculty who are advancing their fields because we believe that it is the forefront of those fields that we should be delivering to our students. I'll tell you a story. We have a new undergraduate major at MIT in biological engineering. And I ran into the faculty member one day in the hallway who was largely responsible for organizing this undergraduate major. And she was enormously excited. She said, I'm just so excited about the lab, the introductory lab for these students, because we're teaching the experiments that the faculty did last semester.
Huh.
And my first thought was, wow, now that's an education. To understand how knowledge is created, to hear from the people who are actually making those discoveries, how they came to be. And, of course, my second thought was, oh, my goodness, that's going to be so expensive. Because, obviously, they're using cutting-edge equipment, they're using cutting-edge technologies, they're using cutting-edge materials, and, you know, these are not stuff that is in common use, and the fact is they are expensive.
Well, let me tie a couple parts of our conversation together here. So the cost issue. And then, you know, back to the first question I asked about basically the stagnated rate at which Americans are going or college completion rate in the United States. You know, I recently read that amongst those students who chose not to go to college but were college eligible, 75% of them said it was because of the cost. I just cannot afford it, whether it's a private institution or even a public school, a state school whose tuition has gone up some 35% in the past 5 years alone.
Yeah. So these state institutions, it's always shocking to hear the tuition has gone up 35%, but in some cases it's gone up from, you know, $6,000 to $8,000 a year, which is, you know, a shocking increase for if you're used to paying $6,000 to $8,000 is a lot more. But I just want to remember, you know, what we're talking about. And the increase in state institution tuitions, public universities, is because of a defunding by state legislatures. And frankly, also because they're competing, they want to offer an education that's comparable to schools that have more resources to put into the mix. One of the things that worries me, really pains me, is when a promising high school student believes that he or she can't afford to attend some of the best schools in America. I can tell you that the best schools in America, some of the best schools in America, among which MIT ranks, now offer really quite remarkable financial aid packages. And we practice admission to MIT, and as do our peers, that admit students simply on the basis of merit without any awareness of what their financial situation might be. And then once they're admitted, we are committed to making it possible for those students, economically possible for those students, to come to MIT. You know, the average debt among graduates of MIT is about $12,000.
Because of the aid that they get from the institution. I mean, and MIT's total room board tuition cost is just over $50,000 a year now. But that puts MIT really as the exception to the rule. And your neighbors a little north of the river at Harvard, they also provide a generous financial aid for families earning below $80,000 a year. But I'm wondering...
Before $180,000.
I'm sorry. I guess what I'm wondering is, more broadly speaking, beyond that small slice of the most elite institutions in the United States, all the other places where the vast majority of American students want to and will be going, what can be done to control costs if, as I said, 75% of students who aren't going say it's because I can't afford it?
Well, I think this is an important issue. Obviously, there are sources of funding that are currently in jeopardy. The federal funding that has provided financial aid for students. I think it is an issue, and I think as a nation we're going to have to really address what we expect a college education to be and not expect it all to be at the same level. We don't all drive the same kinds of cars. Perhaps we shouldn't all expect the same kind of education.
What do you mean by that, though?
Well, one of the difficulties is, you know, we have a set of research universities in America that are simply extraordinary. And as a nation, I would not say I would take this decision if I were making the decisions about how to allocate funds. We have provided public universities that have very, very low tuitions that provide, I would say, essentially a similar level of education, a similar kind of education as the schools that the private schools with much higher tuition. And frankly, much larger endowments that allow us to fund things.
And yet the economy, given the way it's going, many families even find those public institutions beyond their grasp.
That is true. And they find them beyond their grasp partly because the state budgets that in the past were devoted to supporting a very high level of education have been cut. And it's a decision on the base of, you know, by the states or by Congress, where to put their dollars. So when dollars shrink, those schools may not compete at the level that they have been in the past.
Well, we are speaking with MIT's president, Susan Hockfield, and I've been monopolizing the time here with you, but there are many listeners who have some questions and comments for you. Let's go to Framingham, where Ed is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Ed.
Thank you. I'm talking about the costs as well. I think the value has decreased over the years because of the way that college tuitions have gone up and people's incomes have not. My wife and I both have advanced degrees, PhD and a master's, and we value education very much. And we think about our seven-year-old, and we just don't know how we could ever afford to pay the prices that we're hearing about even now. And to look forward, you know, 10 years is kind of scary for our family. So I think the value is turned on its head a bit, which is why a lot of people are really questioning the value of education in terms of its price.
Ed, thank you so much for your call. Let's get another one in here from Danvers, where Edward is on the line. You're on the air, Edward.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is for Susan. I think kids should be introduced to college at a younger age, basically, if they can get involved in college projects. I do some work for MIT right now. I've worked on the flying car and some of the other things, projects that are going on. How do I get my son into there to see what's going on and not waiting till the last minute as being a senior in high school, trying to decide? There's so much thrown at the kids at once at that particular time. Do you have any projects where these young people can come in and see what's going on and possibly get involved?
We do, and you know, it's timely that you should ask, because this Saturday, MIT is having an open house where we're opening our labs and all of our facilities to people to come and see what we do from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And you know, Terra Fugia, the flying car, is going to be there, as will a number of other things. We open the campus to young people in a lot of different ways, mostly high school students. And of course, the MIT Museum has a lot of exciting things on display. We have a number of outreach programs where our students and faculty move into K through 12 classrooms to help students understand what we do. But I have to tell you, I fully agree with you that I wish that more kids, I wish more parents were motivated the way you are to introduce their children to advanced, exciting concepts. One of the most depressing things I heard once was a story of a father who was talking to his son, who was a really good science and math student in high school, went to a great school, and the father said, "Well, what do you think? Maybe you'd like to study science or engineering in college." And the son said, "Oh, gee, Dad, why would I do that? Everything's already been invented." We don't want a nation that believes that. There is a universe yet to be invented. And the thing that I hope every young person will believe and want to be part of is inventing the future.
Susan Hockfield, on that note, inventing the future requires money. It requires funding of research. And that's sort of the other half of things that I'd love to speak with you about today. Before the federal government sort of hashed out the details of its latest version of the budget a couple weeks ago, you and many people in the academy were sounding a very concerned note about proposals to slash government funding of basic scientific research. It turns out that at the end of the day, most of it was saved. The National Institutes of Health, for example, originally it was on the chopping block to lose $1.6 billion of its funding. It turned out to be much, much less than that. So do you feel as if you've dodged a bullet?
Oh, we've dodged a bullet. But I think most people don't understand the importance of funding, not just for the National Institutes of Health. That, for most people, they kind of get it because they understand that the medical miracles that we benefit from today come from the basic research that was done 10 or 20 years ago. But I think people have a harder time understanding what happens in the funding for the National Science Foundation or the Department of Energy or the basic research that the Department of Defense funds. You know, the fact is that all of the innovations that we enjoy today are the products of basic research. And basic research is kind of that curiosity-driven, almost stumbling around, trying to understand how the world works. You know what makes stars bright? What makes oceans change? What makes organisms respond to light the way they do? And it's from those early discoveries that great technology emerges. You know, there are any number of examples, but it was funding by DARPA, one of the Defense Department's early programs, that led to all of the insights that made modern computers possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact is people talk about corporate or, you know, industry-sponsored research, and that's good and that's really important. But corporations can't do basic research. It's, again, non-economic. And that has been the responsibility of federal governments. And I can tell you that, you know, around the world, the countries are trying to replicate what the United States did starting after World War II, which is to fund basic research and to fund basic research in the context of universities, the research universities. So we combine research with education, which we believe is the highest quality of education possible, and then has the added benefit of turning out discoveries that then find their way into the technologies that change our lives.
Well, but I suppose it may be in the minds of some taxpayers, that added benefit isn't really seen directly as having originated from funding that was provided by the federal government. And why is it that you think that people don't draw that line maybe as clearly as you think they should?
Well, it's hard to draw the line because the product of the basic research can be 10 or 20 years off. Herceptin, which is one of the fabulous miracle new cancer drugs, the basic science behind that drug happened 20 years before the drug was available in the marketplace. And, you know, that 20 years wasn't because, you know, when the research began, everyone understood exactly what they were looking for and how the discovery would be applied. You know, we know so little about the world.
But if I'm sorry to interrupt, but if taxpayers look at the current level of funding for NIH, for example, I'm just going to use that because you're a life scientist yourself. Mm-hmm. It's around $31 billion.
That's right.
You know, there are a lot of people today who say, given the deficits that we have, $31 billion seems like plenty. Why is that not enough?
It's a lot of money, and the United States enjoys the most dynamic, most productive biomedical enterprise of any nation on Earth. And, you know, maybe some other nations should do that. What I often call out as evidence of the incredible advances that have been made is what we did with HIV/AIDS. It was within a decade when HIV/AIDS first appeared in the early 1980s. You know, we had no idea where it came from. We had no idea what the organism was. We had no idea how to approach it. And within a decade, by sheer, you know, force of human endeavor, we turned a death sentence into a chronic treatable disease. That's a medical miracle. But we wouldn't have been able to do it if we were starting from a full stop. We could do it because we had decades of important biomedical research behind us, and clever people could pick up a bit from one place and a bit from another place and put it together around this new disease and advance therapies.
Mm. You know, what surprises me, or maybe it shouldn't actually, but around this issue of the importance of government funding, government-funded research for the basic level, the basic level research, and I use basic in quotes there, basic, mm-hmm. It's the farthest,
the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. There's a great deal of consensus, actually, about the import of that sort of across the board, across the political spectrum. For example, John Porter, who is a former 10-term Republican congressman, he actually runs a group called Research America now, but he said America's economic destiny depends upon maintaining and enhancing our lead in technology, innovation, science, and research. Billionaire David Koch, he's just recently funded the MIT Institute for Integrative Cancer Research. You know, even he was lamenting the proposed cuts, which didn't happen, but he was really quite worried about it.
It's not a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue. And so it's easier perhaps to think about healthcare and medical miracles. But the fact is that America's economic excellence, our economic growth, has largely derived from innovation. Bob Solow, who's one of our Nobel Prize-winning economists, actually won the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that more than half of the U.S. economic growth comes out of innovation and technology. It doesn't come out of, you know, having more people at work. The fact is, the United States has the highest level of productivity in manufacturing than any nation on Earth. That comes from innovation. So it's not just that we, you know, do things that are good for people as products of research. We do things that generate new industries. The entire computer industry mm-hmm. came out of investments in basic research.
The reason why I ask, though, is that, you know, one could ascribe the current real laser focus in Washington on deficits to a political minority, very just fierce budgetary hawks. But their thinking is in a way, it's in ascendance. And, you know, I know that you've said, and many others, that if you really want to do something about the budget, you have to look at the entitlement programs. But we also know, at the end of the day, that's very politically unpalatable. So how do you make, or how do you, as the president of one of the world's most prestigious research institutions, how do you think you should strive to make cuts to essential funding of essential research in the United States equally politically unpalatable?
Well, we do it by reason, and when we go to Congress and argue for basic research, we're not alone. Industry in America argues for basic research because they understand that the goods that they deliver and the manufacturing methods that they employ derive from basic research. You know, there's I feel that even if you were to stop, you'll say, why don't we just slow down for a couple of years? You can't slow down for a couple of years. You can't slow down for a couple of years because other nations are moving forward. But there's another really important reason why to have a cliff in research funding is disastrous in the long term. I can tell you there are bright students I see at MIT who believe they want to do space research. And NASA is one of the agencies that has had a pretty dismal funding history for research recently. And they come to MIT and they want to be space researchers, and that they see their brilliant faculty can't get research support for their projects. And, you know, they're smart kids. They say, well, why would I do that? And they'll go and do something else and do something else very well. But what we lose is a whole generation mm-hmm. of research and researchers. So, you know, a short time downturn in research funding has disastrously long-term consequences, both in terms of what kinds of innovations can drive new products and what kinds of people will be available to drive innovation in the next generation.
We are speaking with MIT President Susan Hockfield. Let me get a couple comments and calls in while I can. Jan writes on our website, radioboston.org, we need more engineers, more investors. We are getting more art history and English majors. The best school in America and the world needs to stop allowing students to spend 4 to 6 years drinking. Let me follow up with Jan. She says, yay for more scientists and engineers, but isn't the purpose of a university to welcome a universe of human exploration, though?
It is. But I have to say, I'm sympathetic with her perspective. Nationally, if you look at the percentage of bachelor's degrees that are in science or engineering, nationally in the United States, it's 15%, 15%. Vastly under what it is in other countries. MIT's anomalous. 85% of our undergraduates, both 85% of our women, 85% of our men, major in science and or engineering. But I think what this comes into is, again, not having a national ambition around the products, you know, the things that you can do with the science and engineering education. And, you know, I do wish more of our young people found invention, innovation, and technology to be fascinating fields.
Let's get one more call in here. Ting is calling from Chestnut Hill. You're on the air, Ting.
Oh, hello. I think we need really more role model for invention and innovation. In order to cut the cost, you're talking about the cost, and I think nowadays, big pharma really interested in basic research, open innovation, and they're wondering whether MIT sends some of the students to work with the big pharma. They're very local in Boston, so many big pharma, and they have so much space, there's so much cutting-edge equipment, and in later on, these students may even get a foot into their door, get jobs. And I'm wondering whether that we can solve some problem regarding the cost.
Ting, thank you so much for your call. Susan Hockfield.
Yeah, we do. MIT does a lot of collaboration with industry and with the local biopharma. Ting, thanks for pointing that out. There's a lot of talk and action and collaboration between MIT and the area industries. One of the things I think that you've highlighted, and I view this as probably the only real route to reducing costs, is actually bringing a kind of engineering perspective and actually moving further along the discovery phase for biomedicine. That's the way we're going to reduce cost, is by more technology, not less.
Susan Hockfield, we've just got a little bit of time left with you. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you one last question, and that is how we began, looking to the future, to the next 100 years. How do you see an institution such as MIT positioned for those next 100 years? And what would you like MIT to do to lead the nation down the path that you've been talking about today?
Well, I often talk about MIT's role. One of MIT's roles in the nation is to be a beacon of inspiration around just these things that we've been talking about. MIT has served that role over the last 150, and I think that the nation needs an even brighter beacon going forward, and we will strive to provide that beacon. There are a lot of things that I think are going to be important over the next, I can't think out 150 years, but I can think maybe 2, 5, maybe 10 years. And there's a lot of interesting new areas emerging where different disciplines are converging. One of the areas I think that it will play a big role in the 21st century is the life, physical, and engineering sciences coming together, not just for biomedicine, but we've got people on the campus who are using viruses to make batteries.
And briefly, you might be able to meet some of those people this weekend?
This weekend, 11 to 4 on the MIT campus. Come to our open house. There'll be lots of things for kids of all ages.
Open to the public, labs, classrooms. The whole, if you ever want to go to MIT, this is your chance.
Yeah, you can be in a blimp race and see the flying car.
Susan Hockfield, president of MIT, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today.
There's more information, and you can continue this conversation on our website, radioboston.org. When we come back, a UMass biologist tells us that Alfred Hitchcock's horror classic, The Birds, might not be so unrealistic. I'm sure there's some interesting science behind that. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.